while they're on the blocks, they are assaulted by the detainees on average of 450 times. There's 450 incidents annually. This involves everything from the verbal assaults, which include racial epithets, the most vile profanity, because many of these men are highly educated and speak English with almost native proficiency, and descends down the levels into physical attacks where arms are broken, eyes are attempted to be gouged out, they get punched, they get regularly doused with what they euphemistically call a cocktail, which is something the detainees make out of feces, urine, semen, spit, vomit, and pull their hair out and stuff it in there. There was an incident where a detainee was being removed from the cell. He attacked a guard. He actually sank his teeth into the guard's face. Another guard standing nearby struck the detainee on the head with a handheld radio to try to get him off. He got him off all right, but then because he wasn't supposed to have struck a detainee, he was disciplined and reduced in rank a grade, which I found, frankly, unacceptable. It's not something I would have done if I had been a commander, but I understand the pressures that they're under down there. So,
well, what could he have done to stop it?
Really nothing. I mean, he had to do that. Otherwise, this guy would have taken a chunk out of his face. There's been multiple cases of females being struck, especially. They seem to like to go after the women.
They usually refer
to them on the blocks as, you know, they'll call them infidel whores and this sort of thing, and that's probably as good as it gets. One detainee was in the dispensary being treated, and on no provocation at all, he struck the nurse in the face, broke her nose all over her face, and then she left to get treatment. And he turned around to the others and he said, this infidel whore's blood has defiled my clothes. Give me clean clothes. On another instance, a young female medic who was about 19, 20 years old had been working with the detainee for some time, and he called her over to his cell. She was doing her rounds on the block. And she said, "Can I help you?" And he said, "Well, you know, it's embarrassing. I need to just whisper it to you." And as she leaned her head down, he reached out, grabbed her face, and smashed her face repeatedly against the bars. She's had 16 reconstructive plastic surgeries at this point.
Oh.
So the stuff that that our soldiers and sailors have to endure down there is unimaginable to us. You know, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, this goes on daily, and yet they swallow this frustration, they internalize it. They walk back on the block, they show up every day, they do their jobs, and then they get to read in the paper about how they're torturing and abusing the prisoners, how they're no better than Pol Pot or Hitler's SS. And that primarily for me, Pat and Tim, was one of the motivations that I had to write this book, because I felt like when I went down there, I was concerned, because it's like everybody else. I heard the rumors and I was saying, wow, you know, is this my military? Could it really have degenerated into this? And then when I went down there and found the truth, I said, you know, nobody's going to tell this, and it's up to me to tell the story, because I think that these service members ought to be accorded the respect and the appreciation that they deserve for candidly doing a job that none of us would consider for a moment. Number one, it's never been done before in history. We've never had a detention interrogation facility like this in history. We've never really had to. You know, we've always been in combat with other nation states where we've had fairly accepted rules of war. And even with war crimes, which were typical in World War II and among some of our enemies, for the most part, the POWs we had were manageable and behaved decently. What we've got here, though, is we're not fighting a nation. We're fighting an ideological movement that is sworn to destroy us. And so for these men, what they think is, and their behavior reflects this, is that they simply have transferred the jihad from the deserts of Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, wherever, to southeastern Cuba. They're fighting the jihad in Guantanamo. And we need to be aware of that. I mean, this place is a battleground. It's a constant stress point for the soldiers and sailors who are down there. And, you know, at the very least, I'd like someone, you know, to speak for them. And I guess that's, you know, I'm sort of the self-appointed spokesman. But more than that, what I really want is for the public to become aware of the truth that's going on down there and the ramifications that are associated with closure, because right now that's almost a, you know, for sure a done deal. And yet we're talking about bringing some of these people to the United States, which, the, you know, they get 5 calls for prayer a day. Typically, a lot of them won't believe that the Americans are telling them the truth on the time, so they'll have their own imams, their own self-appointed imams in the different prison blocks will do the call for prayer. Every cell, every block, every rec area has an arrow painted on the floor pointing in the direction of Mecca. So they all have their Quran, their prayer rug, prayer oils, and beads. They have the full prayer kit, so they'll pray. Not all of them do, by the way, but it's strictly voluntary. In order not to disturb the prayer, the detainees have asked, and the command has granted them, that they'll put these little orange traffic cones out in the hallway so the guards will tiptoe around and keep their voices low because, you know, goodness sakes, we don't want to disturb the detainees' prayers. They'll get the first of 3 full meals a day. They eat. They're offered 4,200 calorie meals a day or total daily. And so many of them are actually getting fat, even though they came from the battlefield in malnutrition condition. The meals are halal, which means that they're, prepared in accordance with Islamic requirements. All that has to be flown in, by the way, because there's not a halal facility on the island. On special Muslim feast days like Eid at the end of Ramadan, they're afforded a really terrific feast. It costs, by the way, $34 a day to feed a detainee at Guantanamo. It costs $17 a day to feed an American soldier in combat. So it's a 2-to-1 ratio that we're spending on these guys on food alone. The average detainee can go on sick call every day or really at any time. They see a medical personnel on average 4 times a month, and contrast that with the average American male of the same age who sees a doctor maybe 3.5 times a year. They have access to a 20,000-plus volume library, and they bring the books around to them. They like to deface the books and to send messages to each other on them, so the books have to be replaced fairly frequently. Harry Potter is a big favorite of them. And there's some moderate Muslim works that are in there also. Those who are illiterate receive language training, both in the vernacular, and if they want to opt for it, they can get English language training. Depending on where they are and what their status is as far as behavior, they can be given almost unlimited outside recreational privileges, as in Camp 4, or several hours a day in some of the other camps, or they can be withdrawn if they misbehave by attacking the guards, throwing one of those cocktails on them, something like that.
Yeah.
They get special meals if they are in any kind of medical condition. For example, they might have more calcium, some more potassium, low sodium, extra this. They don't like the carrots touching the meat, so that has to be put in there just right. They may be allergic to something. If they want extra portions, they can have that. They'll do their 5 times daily prayer. They may be called on for interrogation. No one is ever forced to go to interrogation, as the head of the interrogation center told me. If we got to drag them in there, we're not going to get anything out of them anyway. I've seen multiple interrogations. Basically, they sit in a love seat or a easy chair, a lazy boy, and they have a conversation. And typically the interrogators, many of them are women, will either bake something or bring something from the McDonald's or Dunkin' Donuts or something in for them to eat, or show them movies. So it's, it's not 24 where Jack Bauer is pulling fingernails and bending, you know, breaking wrists and slapping guys around. It's more like being in a psychiatrist's room or something, you know. It's not a stressful environment.
The idea is to make them so relaxed. to make them so relaxed that they forget what
they're... Well, that's part of it, but the other part of it, and I've had the opportunity to interview many interrogators one-on-one, they say, you know, you got to respect them, you got to establish mutual rapport, and in many cases, they're proud of it. I mean, I've heard, you know, interrogations where they talk about, you know, I like you. They'll tell the interrogator across the table, I like you. You know, you're a nice woman, you're a nice guy. But if I get the chance and get out of here, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your whole family. They'll brag about their, you know, some of the terrorist acts they committed during jihad. Others, there have been some who seem to genuinely repent and say, you know, I made some serious mistakes. I got down the wrong path. These are the things I did. Some of them have given up others. There were several of, about a dozen of Osama bin Laden's personal bodyguards who were under deep cover in Guantanamo. And then one day, one of the other detainees just said, look, I got to get this off my chest. You know, A, B, C, D, and E went down the list. He said they're all personal bodyguards of bin Laden. And up until that time, nobody knew it. So, you know, then they got brought in and they got talked to individually. And some of them, you know, gave forth information. So, well, one of them, too, on the hunger strike, once, you know, when they first went on it, the detainees were calling the shots. And they were being coached by their U.S. attorneys, their U.S. and British attorneys, who were telling them, take 1,000 calories, that's all. It'll keep you alive, but you'll look like you're starving to death. And so they were feeding them Ensure at that time and were, you know, catering to them. They'd rub their feet in the hospital and all this kind of stuff. And then finally the detention group commander, an MP colonel by the name of Michael Baumgartner, who turned out to be close friends, and he's the one who actually helped me get to Iraq. Baumgartner finally said, to hell with this. You know, they're not running this place. We are. And, you know, they all want to look like they're barely alive and everything. Well, you know, forget about that. So they got federal prison system advisors in and said, how do we do this? And they said, well, here's how you do it. You know, you don't let them dictate. You dictate. Here's how many calories, the human body can accept over a period of time. And so suddenly... This was when it peaked in, I guess, 2005 for the September 11th anniversary, and there were about 131 of these guys. And they began to pump, you know, 2,500, 3,000 calories a day into them, and then they began to look good. You know, the pink came back in their cheeks, and they were starting to put on weight. And most of them said, to hell with it, why hunger strike if I'm gaining weight? I might as well enjoy eating. And so they went off of it, but for a few, you know, really hardcore guys. And so... you know, we took it that way and took it out of their hands because it was kind of ridiculous the way it was going, and the command recognized that.
But that was torture, right?
Oh, well, you know, one interesting thing, because what you read about, you know, let's talk about the hunger strikes for a second. What you read about everywhere is, and the European activists have been primarily responsible for this, about how... tubes the size of garden hoses are forced down their nose, and soldiers do it, and then they yank the tubes out, and they're bloody, and they stick them in another person's nose. Well, you know, it's absurd. They use 3-millimeter diameter tubes, and I saw racks of these things in sterile containers. No soldier or sailor touches the detainee to put this on. It's all done by medical personnel. One tube, obviously, per feeding, then they toss it. And at one point, the commander who was there when I was last there, Admiral Harry Harris, who's an amazing guy, when he came in, he said, okay, do it to me. So they said, what? And he said, yeah. I said, I want to be tube-fed so I know what it's like when I talk to the media. So they did it to him. Like he said, you know, yeah, it felt funny at first with the tube going down your nose, and you relax, and it's no big deal. And once you begin to peel the onion back and begin to see all that's involved in this, I mean, number one is we're talking about people who are self-confessed. We're talking about others who we know are bad, maybe because of highly classified sources that would be dangerous to reveal in an open court situation. Others were scarfed up off the battlefield. And, you know, there's no CSI Las Vegas or anything when you're on the battlefield. You snatch the guy, you put flex cuffs on him, you evacuate him. and nobody sits there with the yellow tape and, you know, does fingerprints and all that stuff. So there's a lot of evidentiary requirements that would be normal and natural in the U.S. judicial system that are going to be absent here. They're just by definition. And what when we're talking about doing this by whatever they construct, it's sure to be much more lenient toward the defendant, if you will, than the military commission hearings. And also, in the military commission hearings, you can introduce classified information, which you won't be able to in this situation. And so what we may end up with are judicial acquittals that would result in these people being either released back into the fight in another country or, God help us, released into this country. And that really, really scares me. There's also a provision in there, what do you do if you know this is a bad guy and you don't want him released? There's no provision in the U.S. Constitution for indefinite confinement. Yet under the structure of the way Guantanamo is, under the rules of land warfare, we can keep him there until hostilities cease. So it's we're much better served having that facility, even with the warts. And, you know, there's not going to be an image resolution if we suddenly close Guantanamo and bring him to any other location. It's not geography. You know, we'll be criticized just as badly. Many of these law firms are working for unnamed Saudi, Bahraini, or other Gulf state countries that are pouring hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, into the defense to twist our legal system against ourselves, same way they've done in the UK. And the other aspect of this is that by having these people brought to this country raises the level of violence so high that it's going to bring even borderline Muslims in this country or infiltrators from, you know, from, say, Venezuela, where they're training Hezbollah, up through this country to make some sort of statement. And that's going to be suicide bombings, attacks on the facilities, and attacks on the installation. I mean, one of the things we've been doing since Leavenworth was named is researching Leavenworth. Well, my God, we found out that the only hospital facility, and remember what I said earlier, that these guys typically see medical personnel four times a month. The only hospital there that can accommodate them is in the city of Leavenworth itself, and it's located adjacent to an elementary school. Now, if we're talking about 4 months times 250, you know, you do the math. We did, and it turns out it's like 30 round trip visits daily. With that kind of exposure, I mean, even the Keystone Cops could mount an attack or something on that. And you know, we've seen, they're right next to an elementary school. We've seen what these guys did the Chechens did in Brezin. How would we like, you know, if you had kids going to school in Leavenworth, Kansas, and you knew that that these terrorists were being ferried back and forth to the hospital every day, I mean, I'd have to take my kids out of school. I don't think I could stand the stress. These are real questions, and they're real people. And suddenly, in what I think is going to be the minds of many fence sitters in America, or people who just, you know, haven't really been engaged in the debate because it felt like it was something distant, suddenly it's not way down there in Cuba anymore. It's right in my backyard. And you know how mobile our society is. I mean, an escapee in Leavenworth could be in New York City in a day. So LA or in Minneapolis or anywhere, you know, or Detroit, and go underground in the communities there, and suddenly we've got a full-fledged, high-ranking Al-Qaeda operative who's working in our midst.
With tradecraft for how to falsify documents, identification documents.
The whole nine yards. I mean, some of these guys down there, we're not talking about a stupid bunch of people. You know, part of what the attorneys have been trying to say for a long time, too, to Tim's point, is that a lot of these are, you know, oh, poor, simple opium farmers or peasants who were drafted in by the Taliban. We've got two guys down there who have advanced degrees from the London School of Economics. We've got a master's degree in electrical engineering, the hardest discipline from Purdue. There's two pharmacists, one physician, A number have graduated from Emory-Riddle University in Arizona and in Florida, where they've learned how to fly airplanes.